Well, if you're struggling to get a good night's sleep, you got to try Purple Mattress. That's right. The founders of Purple are two brothers who've been developing cushioning technology for over 30 years, like the medical beds and wheelchairs. They finally decided to use their patented comfort technology to create Purple. And Purple, we've got Purple Mattress. We have one that are sort of a guest room. Our friends live, sleep on it, and they love it. And we feel jealous, actually. I lie on it whenever I can. Feels different than what you've experienced before. It uses a brand new material. It was actually developed by actual rocket scientists. It's not like the memory foam you're used to. Unique is both soft and firm at the same time. It ends up giving you zero gravity kind of feeling. So it works in whatever position you're in. 100-night risk-free trial. If you are not satisfied, you can return the mattress for a full refund. It is backed by a 10-year warranty, free shipping, free returns, free in-home setup, and old mattress removal. They do it all. Check it out. You're going to love Purple. And now visit – for our listeners, you will get a free Purple pillow with the purchase of a mattress. That is in addition to all the great free gifts they're offering site-wide. Just text Drew, D-R-E-W, to 84888. The only way to get the free pillow is to text Drew. Again, text D-R-E-W to 84888. That's 84888. The word is Drew. You get that free pillow. And don't forget, go to the site and see all the other free gifts they're offering at Purple Mattress. Check it out. Message and data rates may apply.
Start clean with Clorox, because Clorox delivers a powerful clean every time. Because messes happen. Because... I have a charcoal mask. Great, because why would I put that on my face when I could drop it in my sink? This is what I get for multitasking. Ugh, why is charcoal so sticky?
Hello?
Hey, Janice. I am so sorry. I thought I was on mute. No, we don't need to reschedule. I'll just stay off camera. Ooh, yeah, that happens. So start clean with Clorox. Use Clorox products as directed.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Dr. Drew Podcast. Keep the winds in the sails of the Corolla Pirate Ships. Support the people that support us. Blah, blah, blah. Go to drdrew.com. Click through on the Amazon banner. Check everything out there. All the other pods are there as well. I'm going to get right to my guest. I am privileged to have Dr. Nicholas Christakis, physician, sociologist, professor, author. The book is Blueprint, The Evolutionary Origins of a Good Society. Dr. Christakis, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Drew.
So I'm geeking out.
And call me Nicholas.
All right, Nicholas. So I think I heard you on Mindscape or, you know, Sean Carroll's podcast or something, and I'm going full nerd now in my podcast. and so weird.
You've come to the right man for that.
Good. Beautiful. We're going to get into it big. So I figured to start, because the stuff you're into is stuff that I'm fascinated by. Let's start with the book. Talk to me about the arc of the book, and we'll sort of use that as a springboard into our conversation. And by the way, before we go further, let me just talk about Dr. Christakis' background. He's MD, master's in public health from Harvard, PhD in sociology from Penn. He was in this Halloween controversy at Yale, which I didn't know about. I did not know about that until I'm reading it just now. I'm aware of the event. I didn't know you were the one at the center of that, but we can maybe or maybe not talk about that depending on what stuff we get into. Let's talk about the arc of the book.
Right. Well, that's always a dangerous question. You know, when I used to go to cocktail parties with my wife when in my 20s, we would go to a party and I would be working on my dissertation. And people would say, well, what's your dissertation about? And I would launch into this 20-minute disquisition and, you know, Erica would be kicking me.
So I'll interrupt rather than kick if I feel we need to refine it.
The point is, Let me start by then just summarizing some of the key arguments. And then if you want me to summarize the whole book, I'm happy to describe what we do in or what I do in the book.
Great.
So the basic idea is, from my perspective, is that for too long, scientists and the person on the street have been focused on the dark side of human nature, on our propensity for violence or mendacity or tribalism or selfishness. And the bright side has been denied the attention it deserves. Because while it is the case that we are prone to those awful things, we humans, we are also prone to wonderful things like love and friendship and cooperation and teaching. And in fact, these phenomena must necessarily have been more powerful, and I think they were more powerful, than the dark side of our nature. Because if in our ancestral environment, every time our ancestors, you know, if I came near you and you killed me, or lie to me, you know, give me useless information, or were mean to me in some way, I would be better off not approaching you. So we would not have evolved. We would have evolved to be solitary animals. So the benefits of a connected life must necessarily have outweighed the costs. And so the book, so what I try to do in Blueprint is I try to show how natural selection has shaped us to live together in a good way. And so as a sort of subsidiary argument, I also show how it is the case that our evolution has shaped not just the structure and function of our bodies, you know, how tall you are, or your risk for schizophrenia or diabetes, not just the structure and function of our minds, for example, how risk-averse you are or how much wanderlust you have or your religiosity, for example. These are all partially shaped by our minds, which have been shaped by evolution, but also how natural selection has shaped the structure and function of our societies. These things that we humans make, these social order that we are innately pre-wired to form. So I show what are those essential qualities, and I argue that there are eight essential qualities to our social nature: these identity, love, friendship, social networks, something called in-group bias, a kind of mild hierarchy, and teaching and learning. And cooperation and teaching and learning. And these are all qualities that we have that are innate, but that we manifest inter-individually. So, for example, while you can be brave as an isolated individual, that's also part of human nature, let's say, you when we think of love, we think of whether you love another person. When we think of friendship, we think of whether you befriend someone else. So, for example, when we think of religious sensibilities, you can have religious sensibilities on your own. An isolated person can have a religious life, let's say, but we don't think of these other qualities as qualities that you typically manifest as an isolated individual. We think of these as social qualities. And so I analyze how natural selection has shaped those qualities, and I show the kind of societies that we are innately pre-wired to make.
And when you say analyze, you're looking at population data? What are you analyzing?
Oh, goodness. I look at so many different kinds of data and types of information. I use genetic data. I use anthropological data. I use epidemiological data.
To build your argument, to defend your argument. Okay.
Yeah. And I open with something called the forbidden experiment. If you were a kind of a mad scientist, like, you know, in my dreams, I'm a mad scientist. If you're a kind of a mad scientist and you wanted to understand what kind of society, well, let me back up. Let's say you wanted to figure out what kind of body would human beings make if left to their druthers. You probably have the intuition that if you starve a child, it will have stunted growth. But that if you provide adequate nutrition for a child in a typical, moderately healthy environment, their body will just form on a kind of automatic kind of pattern that, you know, our genes program us to have, you know, kidneys and pancreases that function a certain way and eyes and fingers and so forth. And occasionally there are mutations or other things which lead us astray, but we have a kind of a typical development of our bodies. Now imagine instead you were trying to think of what would be the typical development of a society. What you would do if you were a mad scientist, you would say, like, what if I could take some children, some babies that had never been taught anything, and throw them together on an island somewhere and sort of give them enough food and so forth and kind of let them grow up and see what kind of society they made? Now that would be the kind of experiment, you know, in my fantasy I might want to do, but obviously that's, you know, that's unethical and all.
But there have been two things that occur to me that have been close to that. One was a king that threw a couple children in a room, right, and tried to see what language developed. This was in Assyria or something, right?
Well, there were at least four cases. So this has been called the forbidden experiment. So Herodotus describes an Egyptian pharaoh, Psamtik I, who and many other subsequent European monarchs and a Mughal emperor. They all, these monarchs, had similar questions. They wondered what language would humans speak innately. So, for example, the medieval European monarchs wanted to know what was the language of Adam and Eve.
Right.
And so they contrived to, they framed it in religious terms. So
right.
They contrived to take some babies and give them to a mute shepherd to raise in the mountains. to see what language they spoke. And at least in the Scottish case where this was done, it was alleged that the kids, you know, spoke passable Hebrew when they grew up. But so this has been called the forbidden experiment. It's allegedly been attempted by some monarchs, but it's clearly not possible. And so instead, I had to find other ways of approaching this topic. And
By the way, if I interrupt you for a second, I've always wondered if consciousness would really develop in that kind of situation.
Yes, I think it would. I think consciousness is innate.
Yeah.
I think there is some evidence that, it's shaped by our social interactions,
yep.
But you know, I think an isolated individual is fully conscious. If you mean conscience,
conscious. I mean, a self emerges in an interpersonal context. And for a self to also be conscious, I feel like it needs an interpersonal element.
I don't know. I think if we're speaking about consciousness, I think consciousness is totally innate. If we're speaking about conscience, a kind of a moral
different.
Sense,
different.
That's
yeah,
different. And I think that does require social stimulus.
Different.
But anyway, so I hit upon this idea of looking at shipwrecks, groups of people who had been unintentionally thrown together to see what kind of society they would make for themselves. And so I found a database of 9,000 shipwrecks during the period of European exploration of the world from 1500 to 1900. And I found 20 of them in which at least 19 people had been isolated for at least 2 months, and at least one person had survived long enough to tell the tale. And I collected all the documentary evidence about these wrecks and then contemporary archaeological excavations of the wreck sites to try to get an understanding of what kind of social order did these natural experiments, you know, these forlorn individuals isolated on these distant shores, what kind of society would they make for themselves when they were unintentionally, you know, not deliberately setting out to do so? And so that's one body of evidence I looked at. And then I looked at the Shackleton expedition. I looked at the Pitcairn Islanders. I then also looked at the history of intentional communities. You know, since Roman times, people have said, you know, society's screwed up. You know, let's go remake society. Let's make our own society with different rules. And they have sort of split off. And this goes back thousands of years. And of course, there were peaks of these communitarian movements in the United States in the 19th century. In Israel, in kibbutzes, there's also scientific settlements. You know, for example, scientists that spend the winter in Antarctica, they are, you know, intentionally there, but they have to make a society or some kind of social order, and they're isolated for months, 10 and a half months during the Antarctic winter. And then finally, I also looked at evidence from my laboratory where we have developed this kind of software that we call Breadboard. And this software allows us to do these experiments online. It's integrated with online labor markets, so we can hire. We have hired tens of thousands of people who we pay small amounts of money to be our research subjects, and they will log on to this artificial environment that we create. And then we, in this godlike way, can manipulate the social environment to do experiments. We say, well, what if we put the people in a society in which there's a lot of inequality? Versus a society in which there's a lot of equality? Or what if we put the people in a society in which the network has this structure as opposed to this other structure? And so we can do these manipulations and experimentally test ideas about social order. So anyway, I look at all of this evidence, and I show that actually despite – and then I also look at the anthropological evidence, the cross-cultural evidence about social order. And basically what I conclude is that although it would seem to you – or many people, that there's a lot of variety in the way people live around the world, actually, we are there are universal principles about social order. And this is actually a very happy, in my eye, conclusion, because it suggests that we can be united by our common humanity, that human beings everywhere love their mates and have friends and cooperate and teach and learn from each other. These are universal principles, and they're wonderful features of our society. And it provides us a basis for a kind of shared understanding around the world. And then I'll shut up in a second. I invoke this metaphor. You know, I think people, when you look around the world, people are deluded into thinking there's a lot of difference between human beings. But I'm not interested in what's different among us. I'm interested in what is the same. And I think this emphasis on difference, which incidentally is very ascendant around the world right now with populism and right-wing populism and left-wing identitarianism, I think there's a overemphasis on what is different between people rather than on what is the same. And to me, this is like you standing on a plateau and you see two hills. You know, one is 300 feet and one is 900 feet. And you think, oh, my goodness, those hills are a very different size. You know, one is three times the size of the other. But it's just a question of perspective. If you step back, you realize this plateau is at 10,000 feet. And actually, one is a mountain of 10,300 feet, and the other is a mountain of 10,900 feet. And they're not very different at all.
Right.
And if anything, while focusing on the superficial differences of these hills, you have lost the ability to look at the plate tectonic and volcanic forces that are much more powerful and that give rise to the mountains in the first place. And that's what I'm attempting to do.
And tell us about some of those.
Well, I don't know which direction. It's a whole book.
Yeah.
I'll tell you one little thing. So one thing I do is I look at other animals, and this is sort of paradoxical because here's the idea. If you go, for example, to elephants, and the last common ancestor we had with elephants was about 85 million years ago, and that animal was a tiny shrew-like creature, which, you know, we don't think lived socially. But when you go look at elephants, they have many of the same qualities, these universal social principles that humans manifest. For example, they have friendships, and they have individual identity. Each elephant can tell each other elephant apart, which is very interesting, actually.
Yeah.
They cooperate with each other. They have kind of a mild hierarchy. They teach and they learn from each other, which is very unusual in the animal kingdom. I mean, just to digress for a moment, many animals learn. You know, little fish in the sea learns that if it swims up to the light, it finds food there. Some animals learn socially, and that is to say, they by imitation or mimicry of other animals. And this is extremely efficient. You know, if you put your hand in the fire, you learn that it burns you.
Right.
Or I could watch you put your hand in the fire, and I acquire almost as much knowledge that fire burns, but I pay none of the price.
Right.
That's incredibly efficient. And that type of social learning is uncommon in the animal kingdom. We do it, of course, but it's not universal among animals by any stretch of the imagination. But furthermore, we do something else, which is very rare in the animal kingdom. We set out to teach each other stuff. You know, I teach you to build a fire, and that's very rare in the animal kingdom. Anyway, elephants do that too, which is interesting. So what happens is you go to the elephant societies and you study them, and miraculously, when you map using mathematical techniques the social networks, like an elephant Facebook, for example, you map the elephant networks, mathematically they look just like ours.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. So it's very weird. It's as if natural selection, you know, there's only one way for mammals to be social.
Right.
And we converge by independent convergent evolution. We converge on the similar solution. But here's the kicker. So I look at dolphins and whales and certain primates and elephants, Asian and African elephants. But what's amazing about that is that if ironically, our sharing these properties with animals heightens our understanding of ourselves. Because if we can share the capacity for friendship with elephants, we can share it with each other. So the human universality of these traits is very paradoxically strongly supported by us discovering these traits in other animals. So, because surely we're more alike to other humans than we are to elephants. And so, oh my God, the elephants have friends too. So we all have friends. So anyway, so that's one line of evidence, for instance, that I explore, and among others.
So I want to get in. I want to unpack some of your earlier statements, and it feels like you're in the sort of Steven Pinker school. Are you close to that? Are you the better angels of our nature, or what you're interested in?
Yes, and I mean, I see the book as similar to, you know, Steven's Better Angels of Our Nature, right. Jared Diamond's Guns, Germs, and Steel. It's a kind of big book that attempts to explain a lot of phenomena in the natural world, specifically the social world. But there's a little difference, So Stephen is quite correct, in my view, in arguing that over the last 200 to 300 years, with the technological advances and the philosophical moves of the Enlightenment, so we started, you know, we invent a steam engine and electricity and so forth. navigation, you know, safe navigation, and the philosophical moves, you know, that privileged the equality of human beings. Now, these were principles; they weren't always applied, of course. You know, it took a while, but certainly. So Stephen's argument is that in the last few hundred years, because of the action of these historical and cultural forces, humanity has been getting better. And I think he's 100% correct about this. However, my book or the thing I'm exploring is not exactly that. I'm interested not in our history. I'm interested in our prehistory. I'm interested in the 300,000 years that our species has been evolving.
Right.
Because we don't just have to rely on these historical forces to explain or to identify a way to a good life. Deeper, more powerful, more ancient forces are at work, shaping the arc of our evolution and actually shaping us to live a good life.
Right.
And in fact, I could have argued everything that I do completely ignoring the last 10,000 years.
Right.
Which is a prehistorical.
Right. We're looking at evolutionary biology is what we're looking at here.
Sort of, yeah. Evolutionary sociology is what I would call it. But the point is that, yes, so my arguments are completely consistent with both Jared's and Stephen's arguments, but I'm looking at things in a different way over a longer period.
Got it. Now I want to talk about love. I want to talk about friendship. But before we get to those topics, which are huge, you'd mentioned the ascendancy of connectivity and our attachment to one another, and you quickly passed in-group bias as you were.
Yes.
So yes, we have great qualities and good qualities and better angels, but isn't in-group bias one of the sources of where we start to get violent? Is where we act out against the out-group?
Right. So this is obviously very important, very complex. So, and it is also part of what I call the social suite, these eight core properties that are innate to us and that are play a role in the kind of social order we make for ourselves, is this in-group bias or a kind of tribalism, actually, a kind of us versus them mentality. Now, this is a huge topic, but it is innate.
And you mentioned your forbidden experiments. I thought about the robber cave story.
Yeah, robber's cave. I talk about that famous case exactly, that experiment or that demonstration. We can talk about that if you want. But the point is, this is one of the most depressing, actually, kind of things that I've been looking at over the last few years in my laboratories, which is I don't understand why we don't just love ourselves without hating the other. Like, must those go together? Like, why couldn't we just have, you know, think our group is terrific and kind of be indifferent or neutral to other groups? Is it the case that hatred of the other group must accompany love of our own group? And scientists don't have a good answer to this question yet. There's a lot of models, a lot of theories. Ironically, one of the principal explanations for the emergence of in-group bias, this preference for us versus them, is that it was required for the emergence of ours to cooperate with each other. And I can try to illustrate that in the following way. Imagine what in-group bias does is it helps reduce the sense of social scale. So imagine you were in a group of 1,000 people. There were 1,000 people in a group. And I tell them, cooperate with each other. So you all have to cooperate with each other. Well, each one of those people would be like, I don't know who these 1,000 people are. I can't keep track of them, and I don't have the resources to cooperate with all 1,000, and I don't want to cooperate with all 1,000, and so I'm not going to cooperate. Or you might even say, well, all these other people, you know, are going to cooperate. Let them do the nice stuff. I'm not going to be nice to anybody. So for all these reasons, cooperation might collapse in this type of thought experiment, where we imagine a large group of this amorphous group of people that is milling together and interacting with large numbers of people. So you, for example, you might imagine that if there was such a large group, you would bump into a person today and be invited to cooperate with them, but then tomorrow you would never see that person again and you'd bump into someone else. So you would have no ability to expect any kind of reciprocation for your cooperation. So, you know, why would you be so nice all the time to other people if no one would ever necessarily, you would just be taking advantage of you. So the argument is that we evolve this capacity for in-group bias so that now so in that situation with 1,000 people where everyone's supposed to cooperate with everyone, nobody winds up cooperating, and as a result, you have no cooperation in the system. In an alternative universe, however, we imagine that we tell people, you know what? just cooperate with your own group, you know, however defined. And now let's say your group has 100 people. You've got 10 groups of 100. Now, all of a sudden, the problem is much easier for each individual. And so now everyone is more likely to cooperate. So in a world in which you suddenly introduce these artificial divisions, you make it easier for people to cooperate. So averaged over the whole population of 1,000, you have more cooperation. So one of the theories about the emergence of this type of tribalism, this in-group bias, is that it co-emerged with our capacity for and necessity of cooperation. It was a tool to reduce the sense of scale. Incidentally, that's not the only tool we have. We have other tools. For instance, another tool we have is friendship. So right. we are very unusual as a species. We form, like many animals have sex with each other, but we don't just have sex with each other. We befriend each other. We form long-term non-reproductive unions with other members of our species who are unrelated to us.
Elephants do that too, don't they?
Elephants do it. Yeah. Certain primates, not all primates, certain primates and certain whales. But that's it. I mean, there are some other cases, but, you know, so it's very rare in the animal kingdom, this capacity for friendship. And the insects, like, you know, ants and termites and wasps, the eusocial insects, it doesn't count because they're clones. They're like all identical twins to each other. Right. So it's not hard to explain why one ant is nice to another ant if they're the same, basically.
Interesting.
But we're not the same. So hold on. So here's the thing. So we have all this capacity for friendship, which also has a lot of ideas as to why we evolved this capacity, interesting ideas. But from the moment that each of us is forming friendships with each other in this population of 1,000, now everyone has, let's say, about 4 or 5 friends, which is the typical amount of social intimates that each person has. It ranges, but it's about 4.5. So everyone now has their own friends, but everyone has different friends. And so you create structure in this network of these 1,000 people. So now you just tell everybody the rule is just be nice to your friends. Well, now again, just like the in-group bias, everyone can be a little bit nicer than they otherwise would have been. So this trick also increases the cooperation, increases the niceness in the population. So friendship is another path to fostering nice relationships between people in large groups in parallel with in-group bias.
All that seems right and interesting and makes sense. I'm wondering if the more negative qualities, the out-group acting out, could be explained on the basis, maybe this is oversimplistic, but just Malthusian pressures. You know, just the Malthusian pressures and the
Some people, there are some theories that, you know, under resource constraints.
Right. Which was the evolutionary adaptive, you know, of our adaptiveness. There was lots of constraints.
Yes. Well, yes and no. So there are some arguments that during periods of greater environmental variability, when there were periodic famines, for instance, those groups that had a greater sense of solidarity when in competition with other groups, when my group had individuals within it that were willing to sacrifice themselves for the good of the group, was competing with another group which didn't have that type of we-ness, you know, that type of sense of solidarity, that we are all in it together, then my group would be triumphant and the other group would be exterminated. And so therefore, in times of competition, and there's an evolutionary biologist by the name of Sergei Gavrilets, who has a very nice model about this, there are a number of people that study this topic. And so that's one other theory for the emergence of this type of in-group bias, was intergroup competition in times of scarcity.
And all of these forces, I'm sure, were operating.
Yeah, they're not. That's exactly right. They're not either or. And you know, our history, our evolutionary history, is complicated. And you know, science, it's a very active area of scientific research. You know, for the last 10 or 20 years, and it's ongoing.
So let's get into love a bit. Do you define love in the book?
Oh, that's a really good question. Honestly, I don't remember. I don't have the book handy. I don't know.
Love is it's many different things, and it's probably different things for different people. But
I'm specifically talking about the love we have for our mates or our offspring. So I'm not talking about, for example, religious love or ecstatic love.
Right.
I'm not talking about self-love. I'm specifically not talking about that.
But there's attachment. There's lust.
I'm not talking about lust.
There's affection.
Yes, and I do talk about. Yeah, I'm remembering. I do. I define love as a sentimental attachment, an internal experience to a particular mate that one is, you know, having sex with. We're not the only ones that form this type of attachment. You know, birds, certain birds, many birds do it. But it is a distinctive feature of our species. And how and why we evolved to, you know, we could have been a species which just had, you know, very transient sexual interactions. We just mated with each other. But we don't just mate with each other. We love each other. We love our mates. Now, we don't always love our mates, but but in general, that's, we have this capacity to love our mates, and most people love their mates. And this is seen in heterosexual unions, in homosexual unions, which is interesting. It's seen in polyandry, you know, one woman, many men, polygyny, one man, many women. It's seen in arranged marriages, which is very interesting. So even in societies which are very large societies, India and Indonesia and Nigeria, in which arranged marriages, or China, it's not quite the majority in China, but even in which many huge societies in which arranged marriages are the ascendant form of marriage rather than love matches. And in those societies, sort of teenage lust and love is seen as not a good foundation for picking a life partner. And so the whole village or parents get involved in picking a partner. Even in those societies which are very suspicious of love before marriage, universally want love after marriage. Right. In India, love is a very much hoped for and expected outcome of the union. And in fact, when you survey people, for instance, in India and arranged marriages, the prevalence of I forgot what it's called. There's a scale that measures love for your partner. I'm blocking on the name of the scale right now. But anyway, when you use that scale and you measure it, you find no difference in this intimate love sensibility in arranged marriages in India compared to, let's say, love matches in India or in the United States. So love is a universal, loving each other, and it's not, and it likely evolved for very specific reasons having to do with optimizing, fecundity, optimizing fertility outcomes. So a loving pair is better able to raise children, basically.
Well, TrueCar, you hear us talking about it all the time. We love TrueCar, and we love that TrueCash offer as well. That's right. The amount of time it takes to, I don't know, listen to me. You go to your smartphone or your home computer, go to TrueCar, simply enter your car's license plate, see how your car's details pop up, answer a few questions. Then you get that TrueCash offer from a local TrueCar certified dealer. It is that easy. Bring your car in. They check it out with you. Together, you guys check it out. They ask some questions. And then there are no surprises. You simply leave with your check. Uber home. That's it. That's all you got to do. Or if you want to do a trade-in for a new or used, don't forget, TrueCar has used cars as well. Use TrueCar to look at the scattergram for the price of the car you like, so you learn about what is a fair price. You lock in a price, you know it's a true price because it includes fees and accessories. It is true price, and it's for an actual vehicle on that TrueCar certified dealer's lot. So when you show up with your TrueCash offer, you know that car is there, and you can drive off with your new ride. So when you're ready to experience a better way to sell or trade in your car, check out TrueCar today. Well, it also makes me wonder if the mother-child attachment and feelings and bodily-based expressions of that there are really the adaptive mechanism, and then that gets recapitulated in these other kinds of relationships.
Yes, the theory is – that's exactly right. The theory is that the first thing that happened in evolution was that mothers, human mothers – developed this very intense attachment to their children, which ultimately became experienced as love, and that for various complicated reasons, this sense of attachment was eventually extended to their mates, to their male partners. And so people have joked that, you know, like, if you think your wife is looking at you like you're a baby, she is. The kind of love your wife feels for you if you're a man is evolutionarily speaking, ancestrally, was love she felt for ancestral women felt for ancestral babies. And this is I'm about to articulate a theory. This is not known, but there's some evidence for this theory that there's something called exaptation in evolution. And exaptation is when natural selection repurposes something that was intended for one purpose for another. And the most famous example is feathers. So the theory is that dinosaurs first evolved feathers as a kind of insulation, but then once they had the feathers, they could use them to fly. Huh. So the flying purpose of feathers is an exaptation rather than an adaptation. It's an exaptation.
Like an epiphenomenon.
Well, yeah, like it's a, like a redirection
or a reuse of.
That's right, a reuse of this purpose. So one theory is that that although both men and women love their mates, they have emerged from different evolutionary origins, and that in women the sense of love that women feel for their mates is an acceptation of the love they used to feel for their children, and for men, the theory is that the love men feel for their women is an acceptation of their territoriality.
Huh.
That they used to love a turf. This is my turf, and I feel very attached to this turf. And that once I had the brain capacity to be attached to a turf, then eventually that was an acceptation of that capacity to be attached to a female. Now, it's actually much more complicated. First of all, it's just not true. It's not clear if that's true, but it's probably true. But but in addition, every gene over the – not every single gene, almost all genes spend half of their evolutionary lives in male bodies and half in female bodies. So it's much more complicated than I'm telling you. But anyway, the gist of it is that we evolved this capacity from ancestral cognitive equipment, and then it became advantageous to feel and express love for our partners because our ancestors who did that had better survival of their offspring.
In the book, do you get all the way into the genetic and epigenetic expressions, or do you theorize about that?
No, I talk a lot about the genetics of this, and I look at animal models of monogamy. I don't do much of the epigenetics. A little I do, but which is the regulation of the genes. But I do absolutely talk about some of these things, and I talk about other animals that have what seem to be similar kinds of attachments that we do. We're not unique in this regard. The most famous example
is prairie voles.
Yes, exactly.
Oh, yeah, I want to scream when I hear about prairie voles.
Yes. But what's amazing is when they looked, I don't have the book in front of me, so I don't remember the gene right now. I think it's AVPR1A, I think is the gene. But anyway, there's this particular gene that they found in prairie voles that was associated with this tendency to be attached to your mate. And then they went looking in humans, and they found that humans who had the same variant were less likely to divorce.
Oh, that's
so very cool. I mean, it's unclear. This is early days. We don't know exactly if all of this is true, but a lot of it is probably true.
I know Sue Carter very well, and so the prairie vole stuff always comes up. And I heard you on another podcast mentioning something about a genetic. I forget what it was in relation to expression of our facial diversity as having some inheritance. Yeah, tell me about that.
Well, this is also very interesting. So remember, we kind of blew by it early on in our conversation.
Yeah.
We were talking about how one element of the social suite is identity. And this might strike many of your listeners as paradoxical. How could being an individual be relevant to living socially? Well, actually, you need to be an individual, believe it or not, in order to live socially. So, and the reason is that if you're going to live with others, so let me back up. So first of all, you probably take it for granted that you can look out at a sea of human faces and tell one human being from another, and that the reason you can do that is every human face is different. Now,
which is unusual, right?
Yes,
it's already an unusual phenomenon.
Yes. So if you look out at a sea of
dolphins,
penguins or cattle or something, they don't have different faces by and large, and you also can't tell the difference. But that's another story. But anyway, so we have evolved the capacity to signal our identity. We use our faces for this purpose, to say this is me, not someone else. Now, this capacity, and furthermore, and this is an evolutionary luxury. The regions of our genome that are responsible for the structure and appearance of our faces are very variable, deliberately variable. So, like every pancreas should work the same. You know, it should produce insulin, and insulin should do the following things with respect to sugar metabolism and so forth. But every face should not be the same. Every face should be different, we think, and it is different. So this is an evolutionary luxury that we have this capacity of different faces. And not only that, but we have a capacity to tell the difference between faces. So we have all this machinery in our brains that is responsible for seeing people's faces and detecting these differences, which is also a luxury. So why do we have all this capacity? Well, the reason we have this capacity to signal our identity is that it's crucial for living socially. You need to be able to tell the difference between who are your friends and who are your enemies. Your mother needs to be able to tell this is you and she should breastfeed you and not some strange kid who she should not breastfeed. You need to, when you cooperate with people, you need to be able to tell, this is a person I owe a favor to versus this is not a person I owe a favor to, and so forth and so on. So in order to live socially, we have to have distinctive identities, which is completely different, for example, than antelope in a herd. You know, an antelopes will move in herds. They live in agglomerations, but as far as we know, and one antelope doesn't care who the adjoining antelope is. Whereas,
well,
in fact,
some of the, like zebras, their evolutionary adaptation is to the individual gets lost in the, yes, in the sea of other zebras.
Yes, and actually, it's amazing. Yes, you're exactly right. And there's a famous experiment which you're probably alluding to, where they put collars on zebras and tracked the likelihood. But anyway,
zebra gets killed. Boom.
Yeah, we're moving fast, but the gist is we have this special capacity to have an identity, to detect this identity, and this is crucial for the kind of social order we make, especially between unrelated individuals.
I want to do two more things if you don't mind, if you'll indulge me. One is, let's go back over the robber cave, because I did allude to it. I want to let's just quickly break it down, what was learned. And I know it's been sort of reconfigured and reanalyzed in modern history.
Yes,
I still think there's a lot to be learned from it. And then, if you don't mind, I want to talk about the Halloween thing very quickly. But let's do
I just want to talk about the Halloween thing. That's ridiculous.
You don't want to talk about it?
No, come on. Okay. That was in 2015. It's like, you know, it's nothing to say, really. I mean, yeah, it's nothing to say. Anyway.
Okay, then we've just said it. Then that's it. Yeah. I was interested in how you're able to move past it, which I love. Just move on and forget it.
I've been a scientist for 25 years, you know, and I have a lab to run, and I love what I do. I like teaching young people. I like being a professor. And, you know, we walked into a propeller, and we did the best we could. You know, my wife and I, we did the best that we could. And I don't want to be defined by those events, and I do not want to abandon my optimistic love of humanity. You know,
I feel like as scientists, we're better equipped to do that somehow. Like people that get steeped in ideologies and things can't move past these things. That was sort of fascinating. You were able just to. I wasn't even aware of it until just tonight.
Yeah. I mean, I think. You know, I think I'm just amazed by human beings. Look, I was a hospice doctor for 15 or 20 years. I took care of people who were dying. And, you know, you can't be a hospice doctor, to go into people's homes. I worked on the south side of Chicago for 6 years.
Are you an internist by training?
Yeah, I'm an internist.
And
I sort of specialized in hospice care. And then when I went to Harvard from the University of Chicago in 2001, then I was at the Mass General Hospital in the palliative medicine program. And I've spent a lot of time taking care of the terminally ill, and I don't think people in that racket, you can't care for the dying and not come to a very deep appreciation for our common humanity.
Yeah.
You know, you can't stand before the raging authority of death, as Gabriel Garcia Marquez said, and not be amazed and humbled. And have it impressed upon you how fragile we are. And so both because of that clinical training, because of my philosophical commitments to our common humanity, these liberal principles that we are more united than we are divided, my scientific explorations, you know, all of these things tend, in my mind, to the good in human beings. There was a lot of unpleasantness that occurred in 2015. I think the students didn't behave well, but they're human beings too. And, you know, I was just one experience in my life. It's not the worst experience I've ever had. I've had other worse experiences. And anyway, so that's 4 years ago.
Yeah.
So
before the robber cave, I want to say, hey, thank you for doing the death and dying work. I'm just amazed the way our peers just sort of catapult that, you know, the surgeons and the oncologists, when somebody actually needs to die, they kind of go, okay, here you go. And they never get to experience that important part of the dignity of that person's final hours. I mean, it's a really consequential part of the process that physicians are not comfortable with, and I'm shocked at.
Yes. We could have a whole hour conversation about that. Yeah. You know, I think, you know, when you Well, I spent 10 years doing research on how to improve end-of-life care in our society. And my first book was called Death Foretold, Prophecy and Prognosis in Medical Care. It was about the role of prognostication in medicine. I wrote that book 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. I was just really enraged at that period of my life by the awful care we give to the dying.
Yes,
in our
society. I deal with that still to this day. I'm with you on that 100%. I just think death should be an important part of life. It should be dealt with as dignified and glorious as the rest of it.
Yeah, I mean, and I think, and more to the point, or not more to the point. Additionally, you know, if you even today, if you look at, I think something like 40 to 70% of Americans die in pain.
Ugh, that's ridiculous.
I mean, that's just.
Well, let me ask you this. I think if I had death and dying. If I was facing that down, I would contemplate hallucinogen therapy. I look at that research and that looks very interesting to me.
Yes.
Do you have any feelings about that?
You can start with opioids. Now we have another problem with the opioid epidemic. But, you know, when I was in 1996 or 1997, I testified at the United States Senate Subcommittee on Aging about the hospice benefit specifically about some of the problems in end-of-life care in our society. And I was part of a group of people that was trying to enhance the availability of opioids to care for people at the end of life, precisely because so many Americans died in pain. And now we have a further complication because there's been a misuse of these drugs. But the fact remains that the opioids are very powerful and very effective when used properly to relieve people's suffering at the end of life.
That's their target therapeutic use, and the fact that it got shunted over into chronic pain and all these other things, you know, it's like, come on.
Yes, that's exactly right. But the point is, you don't even need to get to hallucinogens. You know, I used to, it was so gratifying when I was a hospice doctor. You know, I would go into this suffering patient's room, and the family was distraught, and the patient was in agony, and we would be consulted, and in those days, this was, 20 years ago or 25 years ago, and nobody really knew how to dose opioids.
Wow.
And you would just go in and you would put in an IV and you would push a few milligrams of morphine slowly, and you would just watch the patient's...
The relief.
Yes,
yeah.
Relief.
Yeah.
Relief. And then the family would... The first patient would talk to their children or their spouse, and the spouse's faces would light up, and...
Yeah.
You know, and it wasn't quite so simple. You had to do some other things too. But the gist was, I mean, it was just so amazing to be able to use this very ancient drug in this very modern way.
Yep.
So I don't think we need to necessarily reach the psilocybin and all the other kind of hallucinogens before, the LSDs and everything else. I think just opioids alone is a huge thing. But
fair enough.
Just a tangent, like one of the things that I write about in the book, in Blueprint, is grief, because actually my intellectual history here was, we don't have time to go into it, but how I was started as a hospice doctor, then I became interested in the widowhood effect, which is how when your spouse dies, your risk of death goes up. And then I realized that was a special case of a network effect. So I became interested in social networks. And then from that, I became interested in the evolution of sociality. So I've done a lot of things the last 25 years, but anyway, grief is astonishing. And, we have grief, and so do elephants, and so do killer whales, and so do chimpanzees. Mm. And it's astonishing that we all these creatures have grief. And I believe, I talk about this in the book, I believe that this capacity for grief is a function of or a reflection of our capacity for identity.
Oh.
Because you grieve for people you know. You might be sad about strangers who die, but you don't grieve for them. To grieve for someone, they have to be a special individual, and you have to know them, could be connected to them. And so I think grief is also a reflection of our sociality. It's this heavy burden we carry for living as social animals.
It might be part of what causes us to defend against loss so fiercely. We don't want to feel that grief. And I would argue, having been in deep psychotherapy myself, you have a grief reaction when you change. You see, you're defended against all forms of loss.
Yes. Any theories? That's one of the theories as to the origin. You're exactly right. One of the theories as to the origins of grief.
Yeah,
it's hard to know why such a painful experience why it was selected for.
You want to avoid it. We fight to avoid it.
Right. So one of the theories is anticipatory grief. What you do is, one of the theories is that the feeling is so unpleasant that you struggle to keep your partners alive, to avoid them dying. So that's one of the things,
That makes sense. And do you have a particular philosopher that helps guide you in your current – you'd mentioned your philosophical orientation. I'm sure it's very personal, but is there a philosopher you're attached to? Obviously, friendship and Aristotle figures prominently.
Well, I love – I mean, you know, I won't profess to being any great philosopher or anything like that, or even overly familiar with – I mean, yes, I have a passing familiarity with quite a few philosophers, but I will say that I read The Last Days of Socrates, a four-component dialogues every 2 or 3 years, mm-hmm. and it just moves me to tears. I mean, you can't – they're just an astonishing – just to watch Socrates die is just unbelievable. And watch the fools that put him to death, these venal, ignorant people who think so highly of themselves, you know, and here this great man goes willingly to his death out of respect for the laws of his city, modeling for others, you know, a good life. It's just, it's unbelievable to read Last Days of Socrates.
And I'm just thinking there's a deep political messages in that too, I think.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think we're in a very dangerous moment in our society and around the world where people's passions are very high. There's a lot of lack of shared understanding, lack of a belief in our common humanity. We see a worldwide rise in populism. It's not just right wings. There's a far right and the far left are both quite threatening, I think, to a kind of liberal order that has brought us a lot of peace and prosperity on the planet. I don't think it's a permanent state of affairs, but I do see, you know, since time immemorial, venal, power-hungry leaders have exploited our tribalistic sense.
Yeah.
To whip up hatred of others, you know, whether defined by sexual orientation or ethnicity or immigrant status or whatever. I actually opened the book with some examples of this, you know, in my own life, things I've witnessed and other cases, warfare, for example. And so it's very depressing, actually, to see. But I have hope, actually. I think we'll see the other side of this. And I wouldn't bet against our species. You know, I wrap up the book by aping a line from Martin Luther King, which is, I say that the arc of our evolution is long, but it bends towards goodness.
Mm, that's nice. Let's wrap up with a little sketch of the Robbers Cave, since I promised.
I mean, the Robbers Cave experiment is a famous demonstration. I won't call it an experiment, done by a psychologist by the last name of Sharif, who in the late 50s contrived to have a group of boys who didn't know each other go to a summer camp. They were 11 or 12-year-old boys. I don't know. I can't remember right now because I don't have the data in front of me. I think they were like 30.
Yeah, I remember thinking fifth or sixth grade as I
yeah, something like that. Now, they were rising sixth or graders, I think, 11 years old. And he showed how easy it was to cultivate a sense of in-group solidarity and out-group animosity. And he formed two groups of these boys and didn't inform them of the existence of the other group and let them develop a sense of identity. And all the camp counselors were actually research assistants. You know, they were all monitoring the boys all the time. It was kind of like a what's that famous Jim Carrey movie where he's being monitored all the time?
Yes. And we all know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
The Truman Show.
Yeah, kind of like the Truman Show. So the poor kids were like in a real life Truman Show. So what they did is they cultivated this strong sense of solidarity. And then about a week into the experiment or the demonstration, they said, actually, there's another group of boys over there. And they put them into zero sum competition with those boys. They were like, you know, they would be like a tug of war and then the winner would get a prize and so forth. And so each group began to hate the other group. And the demonstration was how easy it was to cultivate this out-group hatred. And then in the last phase of the experiment, they created what's known as a superordinate threat. They like an alien invasion. You know, it's like the trope in science fiction of like all the peoples of the Earth are fighting. And then the aliens attack the Earth, and then we all unite to fight the common enemy.
Yep.
So Sharif showed that he could do this. He could manipulate this. They contrived, for example, to have the water supply to the camp dry up. And so all the boys from both groups had to work together to figure out the problem and solve it. And then they began to like each other because they were facing a common enemy. So the point of the experiment was to show how easy it is to cultivate this kind of in-group bias, and also how to undo it by fostering a sense of solidarity, principally by being united against the common enemy. And one thing that's occurred to me is when we look at the ascendancy of tribalism, both on the far left and on the far right, which is amazing to me, like the way these two extremes are so interested in differences between people, however defined. When we look at the rise of that that's so prominent in our society in the United States today, I can't help but wonder whether it's partially a result of the fall of the Iron Curtain.
Other people have mentioned that.
Yeah.
That has been brought up a number of times.
Yeah, I think that, you know, when we were united against the Russians, you know, our internal division. Now, we always had internal divisions. I don't have like kind of a Pollyannish view of history. You know, I understand, and we haven't talked about, but I totally understand that every century is replete with horrors. I'm familiar with pogroms and the Inquisition and the Holocaust and colonialism and all of the awful things that human beings have done. But nevertheless, I think that right now we're seeing a kind of ascendant tribalism, which may partly relate to the loss of a common enemy.
Really interesting. Well, listen, I have you've been very kind with your time. I have worked you over well.
Yes.
The book is Blueprint, The Evolutionary Origins of a Good Society. It's available now on Amazon. You can follow Dr. Christakis on Twitter at N.A. Christakis, C-H-R-I-S-T-A-K-I-S. Website is humannaturelab.net, which is, I'm imagining, yes, that's the Human Nature Lab at Yale. Mm-hmm. And just as a parting question, going forward, what's occupying you? What do you want to?
My laboratory has a very active research agenda. We're working on artificial intelligence and how to add with what we call hybrid systems of humans and machines, and how the addition of machines in our midst will reshape the kind of social order we make. We have a very active research program on the microbiome. Oof. And how the bacteria within us are you know, living among us as well. We're doing some ongoing experiments with social networks. We have a huge field trial that's supported by the Gates Foundation and by the Nomis Foundation and by the Tata conglomerate in Honduras, where we're trying to improve public health, maternal and child health in these rural areas. We're doing a lot of cool things with all the really bright young people in the lab. So we've got a lot going on now and plenty of more work to do.
Well, you exceeded my expectations. It was a real privilege to talk to you, and I would love to do another pod with you about the death and dying stuff, but for another day.
Another time.
All right, Dr. Christakis, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Cheers. See you next time.
For calling times and topics, follow the show on Twitter at Dr. Drew Podcast. That's D-R-D-R-E-W Podcast. The music from today's episode can be found on the Swingin' Sounds of the Dr. Drew Podcast, now available on iTunes. And while you're there, don't forget to rate the show. The Dr. Drew Podcast is a Corolla Digital production and is produced by Chris Loxamana and Gary Smith. For more information, go to drdrew.com. All conversation and information exchanged during the participation in the Dr. Drew Podcast is intended for educational and entertainment purposes only. Do not confuse this with treatment or medical advice or direction. Nothing on these podcasts supplement or supersede the relationship and direction of your medical caretakers. Although Dr. Drew is a licensed physician with specialty board certifications by the American Board of Internal Medicine and the American Board of Addiction Medicine, he is not functioning as a physician in this environment. The same applies to any professionals who may appear on the podcast or drdrew.com.
Start clean with Clorox, because Clorox delivers a powerful clean every time. Because messes happen. Because...
Hey, listen. Remember how you told me to toss those takeout containers before we left for vacation? And you were like, I'm serious. If that leaks over the counter, it'll be a slimy abomination by the time I get back. And I was like, yeah, of course. Don't worry about it. I won't forget. Well...
Ooh, yeah, that happens. So start clean with Clorox. Use Clorox products as directed. Rinse after use if in contact with food surface.